Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available at abletrust.org or 850-224-4493. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Almost 2 years on, officials have yet to name the five nurseries that will grow marijuana for a 2014 law, but the sponsors are pushing towards a new plan bringing the treatment to terminal patients.
There ought to be a very, very torturous level of Dante's Inferno reserved for those who have stood in the way.
Also tonight, some Florida lawmakers want inmates who leave the prison system to have a better shake to successfully stay out.
Are we going to take folks that have, they're doing well with their probation, but then they make one mistake and then we going to punish him and punish him severely?
We'll also talk with a prominent immigration lawyer about attempts by some governors, including Florida's, to block the settlement of Syrian refugees. And we'll hear about a plan to let Sunshine State gas pumps double as lottery ticket dispensers. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Two Republican lawmakers are pitching a moderate expansion of the medical marijuana system they pushed through the legislature almost 2 years ago. Nick Evans reports the measure removes limits on potency, but only for terminally ill patients.
The driving force behind 2014's Compassionate Medical Cannabis Act in the Florida Senate was Fleming Island Republican Rob Bradley. And he says ever since passing that measure, aimed primarily at treating people with intractable epilepsy, constituents have been coming to his door.
And this is not a political partisan issue. Constituents on the right and the left who said, I appreciate the fact that you listened to these suffering families and their children who had seizures. Let me tell you my story.
And those stories have encouraged Bradley and his House counterpart, Fort Walton Beach Republican Matt Gaetz, to make another run at medical marijuana. This time, Gaetz explains, the aim is to provide relief for terminally ill patients by allowing marijuana under the Right to Try Act. And he's pulled in Sunrise Democratic Representative Katie Edwards as a co-sponsor.
So the legislation before you now that Representative Edwards and I are offering would allow dying patients for whom there are two doctors who have signed something saying they have less than a year to live or a year less to live to be able to use cannabis to alleviate their pain.
But there are some, like Ocala Republican Representative Dennis Baxley, who remain hostile to medical marijuana.
We've got a train wreck here, folks. This is a mess. This is not the way to do it. There is a problem to solve, and I appreciate the great effort of the sponsor, but I couldn't vote for this in its current format. Thank you.
Baxley voices concern about an amendment expanding the number of licensed producers of the drug from 5 to 20. Others argue against the strategy, using the Right to Try Act rather than amending existing marijuana legislation. But Bradley and Gaetz say there's a very good reason. They don't want to throw off the Department of Health. It's on the verge of awarding licenses after being dogged by legal challenges as nurseries jockey for those five golden tickets.
Really, Senator, there ought to be a very, very torturous level of Dante's Inferno reserved for those who have stood in the way of your legislation these last 2 years. Does this bill solve it, or does this bill leave us in that same predicament?
That's Niceville Republican Senator Don Gaetz, Representative Matt Gaetz's father, speaking to Bradley in committee. In truth, the new Right to Try bill probably won't have an effect on how quickly patients get the drug. And the sluggish progress of existing legislation isn't the only external consideration. People United for Medical Marijuana is gathering signatures for another ballot initiative. In 2014, their proposal fell short of passage by just over 2%. The organization has more than half the signatures it needs for the 2016 ballot. Some worry Gaetz and Bradley's bill is a way to undercut the initiative's momentum, but Regulated Industries attorney Richard Blau says it could just as easily be an argument in support of the proposition.
We've managed to open the door with Charlotte's Web. We've taken a step forward with Right to Try. The world hasn't come to a cataclysmic conclusion. On the contrary, people that have desperately needed and wanted this relief are now able to get it. And the logical next step is to move forward, again, cautiously.
It should be noted, while Blau is not personally connected, lawyers from his firm, Gray Robinson, represent clients applying for marijuana cultivation licenses and the Florida House and redistricting litigation. He believes the slow rate of progress on medical use is a reflection of the deep unease some in the state and in the state house have with marijuana. Heading toward Thanksgiving, families who need treatment are likely hoping the process will take another step forward by naming nurseries. Then, they'll cross their fingers and hope that isn't followed by two steps back. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Making sure former inmates have a fair shot when they leave the prison system could be a legislative goal in 2016. As Sasha Cordner reports, some top Florida lawmakers say they've heard some horror stories of people getting sent back to prison over minor infractions.
When an inmate is released from prison, they're placed on a probationary period. There are those who knowingly violate their probation, but there can be instances where that's unintentional. That's according to Stewart Republican Senator Joe Negron, who listed off a series of what could be considered technical violations to a probation officer.
A technical violation would be someone is supposed to, over a weekend, they're supposed to remain at home, and they're supposed to be home from 7 to 7, and it's 7:02, and you happen to be in the driveway, and they're 2 minutes late. A technical violation would be they were supposed to make a $30 a month restitution payment, and it's due on the first of the month, but they didn't have the money on the first, so they paid it on the second. Those kinds of things. Things that are technical in the probation order.
Negron was speaking to Kim Schultz, a longtime Miami probation officer, during a recent Senate confirmation hearing of Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Julie Jones. Negron wanted Schultz to expand on what the policy was for such incidences. Schultz says in her experience, it's usually up to the probation officer and the supervisor.
For me, my concern is if somebody owes restitution, to pay the restitution. And I think that's the way most of the probation officers feel. The way I look at it is we help this person get a job. We encourage them. We help them pay their we make them accountable for their actions, and we help them to pay their monies every month. So when it comes to something like that, I don't see that the officers are going to go file a violation report. It's more work.
And she adds, in cases where the offender is scheduled to report every month, she uses discretion as well.
So, for example, let's say he doesn't show up, and I've had offenders where I've supervised them for a while. They know me. I know if they're not coming in, there's something going on. So I think a lot of it is when the officer has a manageable caseload and they can build a rapport with that offender, then they don't look to take them into custody. They don't look to do violations right away. They look to work with that person.
Baker Republican Senator Greg Evers also grilled Schultz on how those determinations are made. He says he knows of instances where someone may be doing well and trying to get back on their feet when something bad happens.
And it could be in the case of a traffic violation that winds them back up in prison. And that's not right. We knock somebody's feet strictly back out from under them, and they have to start at ground zero again to rebuild and go back to where they were a part of our society when a normal person would only have to pay a fine. And that's not right.
Ever says in one particular case, a child of a person in his district was having surgery on a Friday, the day he was supposed to report to his probation officer.
He called and told the officer, and she said, okay, that's fine. Come in, you know, like next Friday or next Monday. Okay, he doesn't come in on Friday because he had to work late at his job. So he shows up on Monday. Well, that happened to be her day off. So through the course, he was actually violated. He's been sitting in jail now for 3 months. Okay, he has lost his job. So, you know, tell me how that was right.
Evers posed that same question of Prison Chief Julie Jones. She says while she'd have to look into that particular circumstance, she's already trying to put protocols in place to give guidance on what counts as a technical violation.
We have been working very diligently with our corrections, probations, our community corrections staff to look at alternative sanctions. And these alternative sanctions are options given to the judge who ultimately makes the decision on whether someone goes back to prison or not, giving them tools in lieu of incarceration to try to affect behavioral change.
Jones says she hopes a bill can be put forward to have that alternative sanctions program, a pilot in some areas of the state, codified into law. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Well, Governor Rick Scott is going to be holding a news conference come Monday in Jacksonville. That's when he'll release his 2016-2017 budget proposal, which is an initial step as lawmakers get ready to negotiate a spending plan early next year. Scott will hold the news conference at 10 in the morning at Harbinger Sign in Jacksonville. He's already made it clear he's going to push for large tax cuts next year and that he wants to create a $250 million fund for economic incentives. He also has said he'll propose additional money for issues such as upgrading Florida Department of Law Enforcement crime labs and improving mental health and substance abuse services. Lawmakers will consider Scott's budget proposal during the 2016 legislative session, which gets underway January 12th. The 2016-2017 fiscal year starts July 1st. Still to come on Capitol Report, several governors, including Florida's Rick Scott, say they'll fight the feds when it comes to Syrian refugee resettlement. A prominent immigration attorney thinks that fight will be futile.
This is a federal issue dictated by the principles of federalism. So they can make that request. It doesn't mean it's a valid request.
And as Florida lawmakers push for ATM-style lottery ticket sales, some worry the game is growing too big.
And now you've got 7 different games drawn weekly, and since the lottery's been in existence, there's literally been over 1,000 different kinds of scratch-off games.
The issue of Syrian refugees has polarized national and state politics following the attacks in Paris. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bipartisan bill to suspend the program that allows refugees, specifically those from Syria and Iraq, from entering the country. Lynn Hatter spoke with a Capital City immigration attorney about what that process entails.
The movements in Congress follow a request by some 30 governors, including Florida's Rick Scott, to stop federal funding for relocation efforts of Syrian refugees without extensive background checks. Meanwhile, mayors in many of those same states say they welcome the refugees. The current conversation comes after initial reports that one of the Paris attackers had a Syrian passport. But there's now new information that suggests that document may have been a fake. Elizabeth Ritchie is an immigration attorney.
Elizabeth Ritchie, you are an immigration attorney. You deal with very complex and complicated cases. Governor Rick Scott and about 30 other governors actually came out with a letter that basically said they do not want the U.S. government to place Syrian refugees in their states. Can they actually do that? Do they have any authority to stop these refugees from coming?
That's a great question. The resettlement program is 40 years old. It's a federal program. And Florida and any other state has no jurisdiction to make that request. This is a federal issue dictated by the principles of federalism. So a state they can make that request. It doesn't mean it's a valid request.
Now, he's also saying he's going to direct state agencies not to cooperate. Is that possible? And what is the extent of cooperation with the federal government in this program?
Well, we are a state, so we are part of the program, whether you like it or not. But his issue, our governor's issue, as many other governors' issues that were brought up in the letter, are that this is a security issue and that they want to make sure that these refugees are properly vetted. Refugees are vetted more closely and more heavily than any other immigrant group. We're talking, by the way, about less than 425 Syrian refugees, by the way.
In my lifetime, since the program started, we've resettled 200,000 Vietnamese, 160,000 Bosnians, 100,000 Iraqis, and now we're talking about 425 Syrians who would take 2 years to get vetted before they could even be resettled here.
What is the process for vetting? How does it work? Mm-hmm. And how does the process for refugees differ from the process of immigrants?
Sure. Well, refugee is an immigrant, but not all immigrants are refugees. In order to resettle in the United States as a refugee, first of all, the U.S. government gets to cherry pick who can come here. Hmm. Secondly, the case would be referred to the U.N. High Commissioner on Refugees, a U.S. embassy, or a trained non-governmental organization. After the referral, biographic information is taken. For example, fingerprints, photographs. A background check will be conducted. Government databases will be checked. Even personal photos and interviews of family, friends, known acquaintances will be conducted. The person would then go for an in-person interview with a governmental official. If there were a concern, then U.S. law enforcement would be contacted for an advisory opinion. And then if the person were recommended for approval for resettlement upon entry into the United States in only one of five airports, would that alien then go before a Customs and Border Protection officer stateside for another set of screening? So it's actually the heaviest amount of scrutiny that an immigrant receives.
So what do you make of this particular request? Obviously, Governor Rick Scott is not the only one who has signed on to it. You now have local cities saying, you're welcome to come here.
All right. Well, it's easy to say we want high security. Everyone wants high security. Everyone wants to feel safe and be protected. But you need to understand that refugees who come to the United States, first of all, do not come for another 2 years. And they are subjected to a very strict high level of scrutiny that other aliens are not. So we have always enjoyed a reputation and tradition of being a humanitarian leader, and the UN resettlement program is a great representation of that. And for certain governors to say that they do not want the U.S. to participate in a resettlement program does not hold ourselves up to the reputation that we've earned and deserve as being a world leader.
Where do we go from here? Obviously, the conflict in the Middle East is not letting up. You have people who have been displaced, millions of mm-hmm. people who have been displaced.
Well, as far as Syrians go, 4 million have already been displaced. Over 2 million are children, and we're looking at resettling 425 or less of them in the United States. So the numbers don't really show that this is an influx of Syrians. And I do want to point out that no refugee has ever committed an act of terrorism in the United States since this program started 40 years ago.
And we know that
There's been no report of a refugee who's resettled in the United States of having committed a crime of terrorism in the United States.
Well, Elizabeth Ritchie, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
When this year's Florida lawmaking session sputtered to a premature close, a raft of bills died along with it. Now, as Kate Payne reports, a Senate Republican is reviving one of those bills, which could expand educational opportunities for students with disabilities.
One of those dead bills was supported by Senate President Andy Gardner, which would have expanded educational opportunities for students with disabilities. One of Gardner's children has Down syndrome, and the lawmaker has become something of a disability rights advocate. But Republican Senator Don Gates of Destin has picked up right where Gardner left off with Senate Bill 672.
Even though my name is on this bill, and I'm proud that it is, this is President Andy Gardner's initiative.
Not all school environments work best for every child, and many parents turn to other solutions. Lydia Burton, a mother of a child with autism, says she doesn't make decisions about her son's medical treatment or education alone.
Ellen has a pediatrician, a developmental psychologist, a speech and language pathologist, an occupational therapist, and a behavior analyst that work with him, some daily, some weekly.
And that therapy doesn't come cheap. But Burton says her son is speaking, making friends, and learning to read because of the Personal Learning Scholarship Account Program. Senator Gates's plan would expand the PLSA program, which helps families pay for school tuition, digital devices, and other fees. The program began in 2014 and allocated over $50 million in scholarship over the 2015-2016 school year. Andrea Wiggins has a daughter with special needs and says the PLSA program gives her family more options.
The PLSA, unlike the many other choice options available, allows me to build the exact educational environment and plan that will best suit her needs.
But some have raised questions about the eligibility requirements for the PLSA. They say that students enrolled in public school or juvenile justice programs wouldn't get that extra funding. But Senator Gates says the dollars should go to students in need. And Margaret Hooper with the Florida Developmental Disabilities Council agrees with him.
So there's a lot of funding already available in public school, so it wouldn't seem right to also have them get these scholarships that people haven't been able to have any access to funding who have chosen to homeschool their child or pick a private school for their child.
Students generally age out of public education services between the ages of 18 and 22, but Gates' proposal would also help students with special needs transition into post-secondary ed. Approved institutions could offer degree or certificate programs and build a new link to education and resources. Margaret Hooper says this would be a dream come true for students with disabilities.
It could mean a traditional degree, or it could be a non-degree program. Or it could be a certificate.
The proposal passed the Senate K-12 Education Committee Wednesday and is now in appropriations. Its companion bill in the House has not yet had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Pumped up by increases in service-related jobs, Florida's unemployment rate inched down from 5.2% in September to 5.1% in October. That according to numbers out today by the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity. In a news release, Governor Rick Scott focused on the creation of nearly 37,000 private sector jobs across the state during the month. Scott called it the highest month for job growth in 10 years. The unemployment mark is the lowest for the state since January of 2008, and the state rate continues to be similar to the federal trend, which went from 5.1% to 5% month to month. The state employment figures came a day after Scott announced that Florida recorded a record 79.1 million tourists in the first 9 months of the year, with the tourism industry now accounting for about 1.2 million jobs. That was a jump of more than 5% from last year. You're listening to Capital Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, how would you like a Powerball ticket with that fill-up of regular? A new bill would let Florida consumers buy lottery tickets at the pump. Lawmakers pushing the measure say it would increase funds for education. But Regan McCarthy reports the opposition worries that money will come at the expense of lower-income purchasers.
The measure allows the use of point-of-sale terminals to sell lottery tickets. Key Largo Republican Representative Holly Rothschein says what that means is simple.
Under this bill, you could get your Powerball, Mega Millions, and Florida Lotto tickets at the gas pump.
Under the measure, people could purchase lottery tickets using their credit cards. That's not something new. Credit card lottery sales are currently allowed, provided the purchaser spends a certain amount of money to buy other goods as part of the same purchase. But some lawmakers, like Miami Democratic Representative Joe Geller, are worried about the added layer of anonymity a point-of-sale terminal provides.
You know, you don't want somebody racking up $100 and then someone can't pay the rent, because even if it's the person, but more if it's, you know, their kid.
And the idea of kids purchasing lottery tickets has more than a few people concerned. Those backing the bill say there are several solutions for stopping underage purchasers, like requiring an ID for winners to collect their prizes. But Cape Canaveral Republican Senator Thad Altman says he's not buying that.
So I'm a 17-year-old. I buy a winning $30 million lottery ticket. It's illegal to cash it in. What do you think I'm going to do with that ticket?
Bill supporters say there are other methods for checking a purchaser's age, like requiring them to click a box verifying their age, or even scan in their driver's license. But they admit there are some concerns that go along with each of those proposals. Meanwhile, others, like Democratic Representative Daryl Roussan, are worried about who the system would target.
And it's not your wealthy, it's not your business owners or people like that. It's usually the working class, sometimes low income. And I'm just wondering the impact of this, because this is expansion.
Roshein says she thinks the program is aimed at what she calls the occasional lottery user. And Naples Republican Senator Garrett Richter argues the move is not an expansion. Richter is sponsoring the measure in the Senate.
I know many members of this committee and some of our colleagues have great concerns about a massive expansion of gaming, and those are legitimate concerns. This bill, as it is right now, without the President Margolis's amendment, is it's a point of sale bill. It's permissive. It simply gives the lottery authority to sell the games that they're currently selling.
Richter is talking about an amendment filed by Miami Democratic Senator Gwen Margolis. She proposed a change in Richter's bill that would allow online sales. Margolis argued that could lead to more money for education. The amendment failed, but Paul Sega with the group No Casinos says it's an example of how much the state's lottery is growing.
When you think about the deal that people were sold when they approved the lottery in 1986, it was supposed to be a once-a-week drawing, you know, with balls drawn before the 11 o'clock news. And now you've got seven different games drawn weekly, and since the lottery's been in existence, there's literally been over 1,000 different kinds of scratch-off games, and they range anywhere in price from $1 to $20 or $25.
Sego says there's no question for him that a new method for purchasing a lottery ticket is an expansion. And he shares concerns raised about people purchasing lottery tickets on credit. He says his group is opposing the bill and instead is pushing for legislation like a bill filed by Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee and Miami Republican Representative Frank Artiles. Their bill would limit the number of scratch-off games the lottery can offer. That measure hasn't gotten a hearing yet. Meanwhile, the point-of-sale bill has gotten positive votes from committees in both the House and Senate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.